This morning in the first hour of the show, we will be exploring the life of Sir Christopher Wren, certainly the greatest English architect of his time. He was born in 1632 and lived to be 90. He designed St. Paul's Cathedral and many other public buildings, and many people would in fact make the argument that not only was he the greatest English architect of his time, but was the greatest architect that England has ever produced. He was, however, more than that. He made important contributions to a number of fields, including medicine and astronomy and mathematics, and in fact, late in his life, he said he probably would have been a better and more financially successful doctor than he was an architect. This morning, we'll be looking at the life of this man with Lisa Jardine. She is a well-known figure in the British media. She was the first woman fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge. She's professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London and an honorary fellow of King's College, Cambridge. Her journalism and book reviews are published throughout the British press. She's appeared on many radio and television programs. She's a popular lecturer. She's the author of a new biography of Christopher Wren. The book is titled On a Grander Scale. It's published by HarperCollins. And she's now spending some time in the United States talking about the book and about Wren, and been good enough to spend the time here with us this morning. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, they are welcome to call. Professor Jardine, hello.
Hi.
Thanks.
Lisa, I think we'll do.
All right. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we appreciate it. What led you to delve so deeply into the life of Christopher Wren?
I've always had a fascination for figures who straddle between art and science. It's a particular love of my own. I trained as a scientist and then I'm now in the humanities. And Christopher Wren is the preeminent example from the 17th century, the age both of great architecture and of the scientific revolution. He never made a distinction in his own life between the activities like his virtuosity as a mathematician, his brilliance as a medical dissectionist, his extraordinary feats as an astronomical observer, between that and the buildings that he drew and constructed and which stay with us today. And indeed, he never called himself an architect. A geometer was what he called himself.
Hmm. It is certainly striking that you look at the man's achievements, all of the areas in which he worked, mathematics, astronomy, science, anatomy, medicine, meteorology, this was indeed a time when the arts and sciences were not as fractured disciplines as they are today. And I guess one wonders to what extent this was, his achievements were in, you'd have to say it was a result of his native ability, but also perhaps made possible by the fact that clear divisions were not seen between all of these various and things, sundry things. So one wouldn't have to feel that one had to be just an architect or an astronomer or a physician.
That's possibly the case. Amongst, let's say, great figures like Francis Crick, who discovered DNA, you know, has a tremendous interest in art, a fascination with music. You know, figures do not pigeonhole themselves to quite the extent that I'm afraid professors in universities like to do when they study them. And I think one of my ambitions is to let the general reader understand that figures are bigger and broader in all periods of time than those compartmentalizings that go on in convenient university departments.
Something else that you say right up front in the book is that he was born at a very important moment, a defining moment in English history, and one where, in terms of politics, things were very unstable. This was, of course, the period of the Civil War, and he lived through that, the battle between the king and the royalists on the one hand, and Cromwell and the parliamentarians on the other. And it seems that he was particularly devoted to two of the Stuart kings, Charles I and II. Why was he such a dedicated royalist?
Well, it is interesting. He was born, his father was a very close retainer in the close circle of Charles I. He was Dean of Windsor. The boy Christopher Wren will have played with Prince Charles, later to be Charles II, and his brother James in the grounds of Windsor Castle. He was an out-and-out royalist in his background. The king in 1642, Charles I, declared war on his people at York, and Wren's family plummeted into oblivion. His father was out of a job. The family went into the country, effectively into hiding. And my own sense is that Wren, who would have been a spoilt brat, who would have grown up perhaps to be a senior clergyman or perhaps somebody who entertained royalty with clever scientific games, instead literally had to earn a living for his family. So you could say that it's the pressure of the revolution, of these unstable times, was actually to make this young man focus his interests and develop them into so they had practical outcomes. And then when the king came back in 1660, when very unexpectedly Charles II returned to the throne after the death of Oliver Cromwell, then Wren was whisked back into prominence because Charles II rewarded all those who had served his father.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, the sense in which one might ask the question, did he and his family pay the price for their close association with Charles I? In fact, that the answer may be, well, yes, but that and the ups and downs of the two Charles did indeed set the stage for what Wren would become.
I think that's right. And I suppose it's also, you asked me at the beginning why I studied Wren or why I decided to write on Wren. His whole era is very similar to ours, you know. The rise of technology, investment in technology, everyone, including Wren, hoping that they might make their fortunes, as it were, from the dot-com boom. And then right at the end of Wren's life, because he lives till 1721, the South Sea Bubble is 1720. That's the point at which it's the dot-com collapse. It's the moment when the stock market of investment in science collapses. So I think it's a period very like our own, upheavals, and where individuals of real brilliance like Wren can somehow forge a path for themselves, and we're watching a man make a career for himself through these difficult times.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Lisa Jardine. She is the author of a new biography of Sir Christopher Wren. It's titled On a Grander Scale. It's published by HarperCollins. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. He was early on recognized for his talent in mathematics, geometry, I guess particularly. Who was it that noticed that, and how did it manifest itself?
Well, oddly, it was a medical man who noticed. Charles Scarborough, who'd been a royal physician to Charles I. Medics in civil wars do rather better than the rest of the royal servants because you need as many doctors as you can get, and he continued doing rather well through the Commonwealth. And he took in the young Christopher Wren to be a kind of household servant, really. And he discovered he had this extraordinary mathematical ability, introduced him to the great mathematician Oughtred, and together they did some very fundamental mathematics before, really, Wren was in his teens.
Mm. It seems that he early on demonstrated a kind of artistic talent in the sense that he apparently was very good at drawing diagrams and making models and in representing scientific ideas in visual ways.
He drew like an angel. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm making this big effort to make him into a rounded person with all these interests, as indeed he did. But the way that he could draw must surely have had an extraordinary influence on the direction that his life ultimately took. To begin with, however, he drew, for instance, he made drawings for a man called Thomas Willis's published work on the anatomy of the brain, rendered the drawings from which the engravings were taken. But by the 1660s, he's producing the most beautiful color-washed drawings of building proposals, some of which I produce in color, reproduce in color in the book.
When he went to university, he went to study mathematics?
No, it's kind kind of a liberal arts that, well, that's, I suppose, a little bit, yes. A boy like him went to college to study a general degree. But again, he was noticed by John Wilkins, the warden of Wadham College, Oxford, another closet royalist, and he was taken into his circle, where he immediately began developing. He built a beehive, a wonderful beehive, with glass panels in it and little statues on the top for Bishop Wilkins. And the diarist John Evelyn saw it in 1656, ordered one for himself, and the young Wren was sort of on the road to success because he'd been noticed for making, well, that's his first building. I think the beehive was his first building.
How did he then make this move from being much into a number of things, but into mathematics, make that move from that into astronomy?
Again, another old friend of his father, Sir Paul Neale, who in exile from the court, because there wasn't a court anymore, in the 1650s in the country, decided that astronomy was his passion, started building large telescopes and hiring the men to help him both make the lenses and take the observations, and Wren moved into his household and began to do that. He turned out to be, I think he was extraordinarily good with his hands as well as with his mind. He ground lenses particularly well and very quickly became very highly regarded in astronomy.
This also was a time when, I'm not certain what the status of architect as a profession was. At least I don't believe that one would go, one wouldn't go to university to study to be an architect. How then did he go from, now he's from he went from mathematician to astronomer to, that seems not such an unlikely leap, but from astronomer to architect, that does seem like a leap.
And I think the step to being an architect for Wren was an accident. It was a curious accident. As I said, the king, the returning king in 1660, swept what I call the lost boys, the boys who had lost much of their court career during the 1650s, swept them into the court. Wren had been building a room for Wilkins at Oxford to support the telescopes. He was strengthening the floor of a room in the old schools at Oxford to carry a heavy telescope. He moved into the King's Circle in London. The King moved into a rundown ramshackle palace, which had been used by Oliver Cromwell to billet his troops in, and he wanted it refurbished. Here's a young man who knows how to build strong floors, and he immediately gets him to design, to draw up some designs to renovate Whitehall Palace, and really doesn't look back from there. Pretty soon after that, he's asked to do some surveying work on Old St. Paul's Cathedral, which the king also wishes to renovate. And, you know, we know that he ends up, after the fire, rebuilding St. Paul's Cathedral.
Mm-hmm. Well, was it primarily his skills, initially his skills as, I guess one would say, an engineer that got him noticed and not so much as an artist?
Yes. I think that is so, although the drawings, of course, as we've said, he drew so beautifully. I think that brought him, there's a wonderful drawing of Whitehall that I reproduce in color, which is, I think, dated to 1662 to 3, and is so beautiful, I don't see how the king could have failed to take notice of it. However, it was his capacity to make things stand up, which got him the early jobs, though I would have to qualify that by saying Charles really gave friends of the family jobs, whatever their skills. He gave John Denham, the first person to become his royal surveyor, looking after buildings, was a man called John Denham, who was a poet, but who'd done some very courageous things for Charles I, running money to him in exile in the country. And he got the job of surveyor. He, as far as we know, didn't know how to put up buildings at all.
This certainly is a time when architectural drawings were extraordinarily beautiful. And I know that it was, I think it was the fashion at this time, wasn't it, for people who were wealthy and had grand houses to have architectural drawings made of the houses that presumably they would, I guess they would hang them on the wall.
They become an art form. You know, they still are. You know, there will be people who are itching to buy those Libeskind and Sink drawings for the propositions for Ground Zero. Mm. And they are a beautiful art form in themselves. Wren didn't do private homes. Because he was the royal surveyor, he was wholly occupied with with royal palaces and public buildings. Those who followed him, like Hawksmoor and Vanbrugh, and then Burlington, who all produced grand homes for grand people whose brief was simply to make it as great and as beautiful and as imposing as possible, their drawings become particularly coveted.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. First is in Champaign County. That's line number one. Hello.
Right. You kind of went over this idea of the status of the architect. I heard you on the Diane Rehm show, and you there said that architects and anybody who sort of worked with their hands, makers, were sort of looked askance at, that it was just sort of the philosophical division between the vita activa and the contemplative life, and doctors were thought more of being sort of akin to philosophers, it seems. And so he came into this, well, you didn't emphasize, at least I don't recall from that interview, the talk about the Cromwellian Revolution and the reinstatement of the monarchy, which was, so I'd like for you to expand on that latter, but also, what do you think of this? I mean, and that was his regret at the end of his life, too, wasn't it? That he could have been a famous doctor or something.
Yes,
he could have not troubled himself with all these, you know, material things or some such, even though they are the...
I think I'd put that aside. I'm delighted you're following me around the country. But the issue is that Wren has no option as to the practical life or the contemplative life. He's right in there being practical. Had his father stayed in his senior role, fine. His son could have been a dilettante or a contemplative. The distinction in Wren's mind between medicine and architecture, I'm afraid, was that he felt at the end of his life he hadn't left enough money to his son, and he believed correctly that he would have made a great deal more money as a physician, or rather as an advisory doctor to great men and women, than he did as an architect when he rarely got paid. Architecture was then a very applied subject. It isn't until a century later that gentlemen architects produce purely visual schemes. I think of Wren as an engineer. So that's to answer the first half of your question. Then this issue of the change of regimes, the more I think about it, the more I write about the scientific revolution, to which Wren belongs, and which covers the period probably, let's say, 1655 to 1670, across from the Commonwealth, 1650 to 1660, to the Restoration, 1660 onwards. It's about dovetailing the practical with the intellectual. It's the first time that it becomes truly respectable to do what Wren does, to climb up the scaffolding. He used to get himself hoisted to the top of St. Paul's in a basket, we're told, in order to look at how the masonry was going up, in order to take decisions structurally, and that tells us that he's a hands-on man, and that is the scientific revolution.
It seems that the Cromwellian Revolution was probably a split consciousness or split minds about this whole idea of the value of work. I mean, it's Calvinism, but at the same time, I think that it's sort of this Christian be in the world, not of the world, so... I don't know. Maybe that's why it failed or something. But,
well, no, I think you can tell I'm an arch pragmatist. You know, my Cromwellian revolution is about a king who was extracting taxes and levies on his people, which were intolerable, replaced by a much more egalitarian regime whose church, yes, is also more egalitarian, whose spirituality is more democratic. But in the end, I'm afraid, as in all changes of regime, it's politics that rules.
What was the pillar that he did do the pillar there? That's now sort of, I think I was on it once.
The monument to the Great Fire.
So that's what it was about. Okay, I had forgotten what the impetus and where the money came from.
Yes.
But I'll let you explain that. And I think there were some other ramifications of that?
The Monument to the Great Fire, which Wren and his close friend and site architect, Robert Hooke, designed and built together, is a 200-odd-foot column. You can find it at close to Monument Station, a short walk from St. Paul's. It is a monument to the Great Fire. In many ways, it was thought of as a focal point for thinking about the trauma of the Great Fire of London, much as literally today you're thinking about what to put back at Ground Zero. It was a vertical column. It is a vertical column with a great gilded flaming urn at the top with an inscription at the bottom reminding us how many people died, how many homes were left. But I discovered that it was also designed as a very large vertical telescope, that there's a laboratory in the basement, that the roof hinges, and that you can look at the stars vertically above the basement. So it's a twofold building, very much a building close to Wren's heart, in that it is at once a monument but has scientific use value.
Just to go back to this issue of the Cromwell and the Restoration, I guess I'm still interested in, you know, you write in the preface to the book very clearly that Wren was born at a time when, you write, the intellectual world was changing with astonishing rapidity, providing a fertile environment within which his extraordinary mind burgeoned and blossomed. And I guess I am wondering, you know, to what extent each of the two times, that is the period in between the two Charles and then the Restoration, contributed to that atmosphere? And was it more one or the other? And if for example, there had not been that break between the two kings, whether things would have been different?
I think Wren is a paradigm for the difference, because the royalists were... It was a totalitarian regime, and the small man and collaborative activity were underrated and downgraded. It was all about rule from the top, as it might be in any developing country today. At the Revolution, Wren was not in favor. So his family is not there. Whatever's going on during the Revolution, he's not there to take part in it. However, in the country, the very same, you might say, mentalities are at work. Groups of royalists are having to get together to try and struggle for a living together, just as groups of republicans are making grand new institutions which are more democratically structured. So you get the injection of teamwork, of group thought, of collaborative endeavor. Then the king comes back, and ironically, the people who carry that flame on are not Commonwealth men, as we used to think. They're royalists who come back, but with that same mentality of now looking around them. They've been working with skilled artisans. They've been working with telescope makers. They know now that you can't just live the vita contemplativa. You can't just do it all by yourself in an ivory tower. You're going to hire your artisans, you're going to hire your skilled technicians, and you're going to move the world forward. So yes, that interruption, I think, very importantly, made Britain much more of a republic. And of course, in 1688, it became a constitutional monarchy.
We are at our midpoint of this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Lisa Jardine, is professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London and is the author of the book On a Grander Scale, The Outstanding Life of Sir Christopher Wren. It's published by HarperCollins and is indeed a biography of the life of the great English architect Christopher Wren, the designer of St. Paul's Cathedral and many other public buildings. But he also was more than an architect. He was very interested in and had great talent in other fields as well, including mathematics and astronomy, and interested in anatomy and medicine and other aspects of science. The book is out in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller up is in Lovington on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Several years ago, my wife and I were in Windsor and wandered around the town, and we saw the town hall. Are you there?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I sounded dead. And the story we were given was that it was designed by Wren, and the town fathers thought that he didn't provide enough columns to hold up the portico, I guess you would call it, in front of the building. And so he added the extra ones that they wanted. But many years later, when they were doing some renovation, they discovered that those extra columns didn't go all the way up, and that he had just plastered over the top so that you couldn't see the gap. Do you know whether that's a true story? It sounded too good.
I love that story. I'm afraid it's not a true story.
That's what I thought.
I love that story because it's told of at least four buildings that Wren is supposed to have built.
I see. Okay.
Now, I'm a storyteller myself, and I know that where there is a story, there is a grain of truth. So there is a grain of truth to your story. The building to which, incidentally, I don't think the Town Hall in Windsor is by Wren, but that doesn't matter either because any beautiful neoclassical building in England is now, and indeed at William and Mary College in the States, is attributed to Wren. So that's fine. That just tells us that he was a preeminent architect, and those who emulated him get the dubious pleasure of being erased from history, and he's put in their place. Now, the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford is the building to which that story most closely pertains. It is a building with a remarkable roof. It was one of Wren's early buildings. It was built for Bishop Sheldon, who had come back to be Archbishop of Canterbury and wanted, after the Restoration, built it as a thanks offering for the Restoration. And it was built to house the public ceremonies of the University of Oxford. So it is a theatre. It has a huge spanning roof. It is supposed to take processions and choirs and goodness knows what and orations. And the roof is a broader span than any building there heretofore, before it was hitherto. The university professors, we are the pedants to end all pedants, were deeply anxious about whether it could really self-support. It is said that extra pillars were added, and indeed that there was a gap. So because Wren knew that ultimately someone would take a look and find they'd been unnecessary. The point being, as you know, they don't reach the roof. So the roof is not supported on those pillars, although to the eye it looks as if the roof is. Now, I'm afraid that isn't true even of the Sheldonian, but it does tell us that Wren was working at a point like the Sydney Opera House or like the Guggenheim at Bilbao, where what he's building is so at the cutting edge of materials and structural skills that people are nervous that it might fall down. They are bravura great statements in architecture, hard for us to understand that today, and therefore people were nervous, and you know what? He was such a great engineer, they didn't fall down.
Well, I'm a bit disappointed, but it's nice to know the truth.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to next person in line, Belgium, Illinois, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I was wondering, was Newton and Wren contemporaries?
They were indeed.
Could you talk about their relationship? I'm sure it must have been interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What a lovely question. Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. Newton and Wren were, in some ways, quite similar as prodigies. They knew each other best through the Royal Society, which is established in the early 1660s as a group of intellectuals with an interest in science under the patronage of Charles II. Wren was a founder member. Newton wasn't a founder member. He, at that point, was a rather reclusive mathematician in Cambridge. Didn't actively join the Royal Society until the late 1670s, indeed the 1680s. But Wren was in touch with him in the 1680s when Wren and Halley, another member, and Robert Hooke believed that Newton would be able to solve the problem of what the orbit would be of a heavenly body moving around the sun with the sun at the focus of whatever the curve was it went around. And they actually sent Halley in 1684 to Cambridge to consult Newton. Newton said immediately it would be an ellipse. Out of that came all the work that Newton did to produce the Principia in the late 1680s, 1687. And from then on, he and Wren are very closely involved around astronomy, mathematics, and Wren is president of the Royal Society, and Newton follows him a few years later as president of the Royal Society. They were very close.
All right, let's continue. And the next caller here in line is on our line number 3, and that is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, about the Royal Society is the part that I'm most interested in. I understand it's closed to the public. I don't know if you've ever gotten in there.
Do you know what? You only have to go and ask. You can go, of course, you know, I get in there, but that's because, you know, I work on their archives. But in fact, like the New York Public Library, it is one of those places where you are entitled to go and look in that library, whoever you are as a member of the public. They are absolutely delightful there. And in their library, in a glass case, is the charter of the Royal Society, the first charter, and Wren's signature is boldly there as one of the first signatories.
Oh, that's good to know. Thanks. And, I had a couple questions. One is, since he was involved in the architecture of so many churches, and yet he was a founder of the Royal Society, was there a tension between religion and science as there has been in this country at all?
There's an interesting rule in the statutes of the early Royal Society that members shall discuss neither politics nor religion at the meetings. That doesn't mean that they were apolitical or atheistical. And indeed, Wren remains a very devout, extremely devout Anglican, that is to say, a Protestant with high Catholic leanings, but who regards the king rather than the Pope as the head of the church, still the established religion, the state religion of Britain today. So there isn't a tension, and indeed, I would almost say, it's a nice thought that you've just given me, that I would almost say that those wonderful churches, over 50 churches in whose design Wren was involved after the Great Fire, all of which have sophisticated structural and engineering aspects to them, that in a sense they too are a tribute to the hand-holding between science and religion, and they're not being at odds with one another. It's largely over evolution and mankind that science has such difficulty with religion and vice versa. I think in the area of mechanics, astronomy, and those fields that Wren was involved in, there's less clash or collision between them.
Hmm. I read an article that there's a Titian show coming up in London.
Yes.
And I was curious if there was any connection between Wren and Titian.
No, there isn't. I laughed only because the last radio program I did before I left on this book tour was an hour-long program on Titian in which I was. So I can say with confidence that aside from the fact that both Wren and Titian drew like angels, there's not an overlap because Titian's career is over just as Wren's begins.
Well, I thought he might. I imagine he traveled to Italy, though, and he.
No. Wren couldn't travel to Italy. Mostly Protestants couldn't go to Italy. He went to France, he went as far as France, and his close friend John Evelyn, the diarist, had traveled extensively in Italy in the 1640s and brought back a lot of books and engravings and drawings and his own records of things there. So, no, that's quite a fair comment. I have little doubt that Evelyn would have talked to Wren about Titian's paintings.
And another cross-cultural interesting point is that Wren really wanted to make the London after the fire look like Paris. Could you talk about that a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Another lovely question. Wren, we are the Great Fire of London, let me just say, and it's a sensitive moment to say it, but the Great Fire of London was as calamitous, as devastating, and as traumatic for London as 9/11 was for New York. The loss of life was less, although, believe me, when they say no lives were lost in the Great Fire of London, they just meant then, unfortunately, nobody important died. But the loss of the ripping out of the commercial heart and the cultural heart and the living, beating heart of the city had the same kind of impact. Wren came forward within a week with a plan for rebuilding the city of London. It was a city like Paris today. I was corrected by a caller, in fact, on a call-in show that of course, Paris under Louis XIV didn't yet look like Paris today, with the étoile and the avenues, radial avenues, and the avenues of trees, and the glorious vistas. But nevertheless, that was what Louis XIV was already drawing up plans to do. Wren drew a plan for London of that magnificent kind. And when he was told by the Corporation of London, as it were the client for the job, alongside the king, that this was impossible because this was a democracy, people had to be given back their homes, people were traumatized by this fire, they could not be evicted from their accommodation, even if it was burnt to the ground. He lost his temper for one of the few times in his career and said the world would look on this as a wasted opportunity, that this should be the moment for London to become a city more grand than Paris. And you know what? He lost that argument, but he was given St. Paul's. So it is worth reflecting that London as it was rebuilt, that is to say, largely on the old street pattern, a memorial in the sense of preserving the memories of what had been lost in the fire, but with a bold, brave, glorious statement at its apogee, where the fire had started, of St. Paul's Cathedral, given to the great architect to make a statement that would last for all posterity, it has indeed. So St. Paul's is effectively the monument for which you're looking at the moment in New York as a monument to the catastrophe of the World Trade Center. Mm.
You know, just in the news recently here, we have heard about the fact that London is so crowded and there's so much auto traffic that the mayor has put in place this plan that at least in a section of London, people, if they're going to take their cars in, are going to have to pay a daily fee.
It's great.
And one wonders whether if Wren had his way and rebuilt the city he had liked, whether it would function any better today than it does.
It probably would, you know. Paris is congested with traffic, but it careers at enormous speed around great places and places and down long avenues which are broad enough to take them. No, the streets of London are too narrow because after the fire, although they were marginally widened, they were mostly left as they had been. But believe me, the congestion charge, I live in central London and we are thrilled with the congestion charge.
Well, I gather not everyone is thrilled with it, but that apparently a significant number of people are. Our guest for the program, Lisa Jardine. She's professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London. She's the author of a new biography of Sir Christopher Wren, the English great English architect, designer of St. Paul's Cathedral. The book is titled On a Grander Scale, and it's published by HarperCollins. We have about 10 minutes left. We have other callers. We will continue. And next is line two. The caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. I missed the first half of the program. I'm sorry, but I was very interested in telling everyone that if they wish to see a Wren church, they only have to go to Fulton, Missouri.
That's true.
And it's lovely. I discovered it by accident. I wanted to see the Churchill. This is Winston Churchill mm-hmm. Memorial. I knew there was a great statue there. And having viewed this marvelous statue, I said, oh, look at that church. Isn't that gorgeous? And that's when I discovered there was a full library to Churchill down below. And that is the place that he gave his famous Iron Curtain speech, because Harry Truman asked him if he'd come to Missouri. And then later it was arranged that one of the churches in London, which had almost been totally destroyed in the Second World War, they just couldn't rebuild all of them. So the church was taken apart stone by stone, everything marked, shipped to Fulton, Missouri, and that they can see a Wren church without leaving this area.
That's absolutely true, and it's a wonderful story too, because it was a real crisis after World War II to decide there wasn't enough money to rebuild all the damaged churches. St. Paul's was intact because Churchill himself had said that St. Paul's must not be lost. It was, you know, it was the monument for London, the great focal point. And so there were points during the Blitz when the firefighters were taken away from commercial buildings and played their hoses constantly over St. Paul's so that it was not lost. However, of the more than 50 churches that Wren had rebuilt, a number were very, very badly bombed. And it is certainly the case that a number, it was decided, would not be rebuilt and that all the effort would go into ones like St. Stephen Walbrook with its beautiful wooden dome. And therefore, the people, I think, of Fulton, Missouri showed the great initiative of putting together the Churchill memorabilia with a real Wren church. Now, the only thing I'd say about that church is it suffers from all other rebuildings of Wren churches in that the interior is this pristine, white, unadorned interior. Now, unfortunately, that reflects the tastes of the post-war period. Wren himself, I would have to say, was a great man for frills and furbelows. His churches would have been painted inside. They would have been wood-paneled. Grinling Gibbons's brilliant wooden, luscious, cascading garlands of fruit and flowers, all made out of wood, carved out of wood, would have been everywhere. Candles, icons, statues. Wren was a high church man. So you have to think of each Wren church that you visit, close your eyes, look at the beautiful structure, and then think of it as absolutely crammed like any South American church with all that tat.
Two more things. It's on the campus of Westminster College, if
Great.
Anyone goes to Fulton. And then, after the Berlin Wall was torn down, Churchill's daughter made arrangements for part of the wall by dealing with a high communist, you know, East German communist official, and got part of the wall, and they made a sculpture out of it.
It's and beginning to sound like a Japanese theme park.
No, not really. There's just the outside. There is just part of a small part of the wall, and then the very lovely statue of Winston Churchill.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on. We have another call here. They're in Urbana. That's next, line three. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you'd comment a bit more on a question raised by an earlier caller. It seems to me this was a period in which religion and science were not antagonists. And you see figures such as Priestley in Britain and, I guess, later in this country, and Cotton Mather in this country, who are great theologians as well as prominent scientists.
The figure that I'd like to, you know, draw listeners' attention to, because he's a wonderful figure to study, would be, is John Wilkins, that man I said, the mentor of Christopher Wren. He was a cleric. He became a bishop. He was already a chaplain when he was encouraging science at Oxford. The whole development of science in Britain, in the Royal Society, was within a framework of a very outward-looking, thoughtful, and intellectual Christianity, which of a somewhat non-sectarian sort. Wilkins regarded himself as a pluralist. He was reluctant to discriminate amongst Christian sects, and he was renowned for being somebody who could soothe the difficulties between sects. He's also developing science to a very high level. I think we should revisit that issue. The split comes much later. Of course, you know, there are very many outstanding scientists who remain committed believers, whatever their faith. But the issue of the separation of science or the notion that you would have to be a non-believer is much later. And indeed, Wren and his contemporaries thought of God, as you will probably know, as presiding over, like the master clockmaker, over a great, glorious, exquisitely functioning mechanical universe in which all the pieces fitted together, and God cherished this mechanistic world, this world susceptible, amenable to scientific explanation.
It was an age of great optimism.
Yeah, indeed.
Go ahead, please.
I was going to say I'm a great optimist myself. I only study periods of great optimism.
Newton, coming from Cambridge, I suppose must have been a Congregationalist.
He was actually a very curious sectarian. He was a schismatic, and I've forgotten, I'm afraid, I think he was an antinomian, and he actually had great trouble. When he moved into prominence, he moved after the arrival of William and Mary. He'd been a great opponent of James II, the Catholic king, in Cambridge. In fact, he'd become a hero of the academic community in Cambridge as an opponent of the Catholic King James, came to London to be a great political figure under William and Mary in 1689 or so. He had difficulty because his Christianity was of a curiously schismatic kind. But again, he was able somehow to square that with what was going on in the country at large.
Well, perhaps that's another book for you.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We're coming down to the point here where we unfortunately have to stop. Wren was lived, I think, until he was 90, which seemed indeed. For the time to be a rather extraordinarily long life.
Yes.
He's buried in St. Paul's, and there on the wall is written probably one of the most famous things anybody has ever put up on a monument anywhere, and that it was put there by his son, who says, it says, "Reader, if you seek a monument, look around you."
If you require a monument, look around you. Wren would have hated that inscription because he was a very self-effacing man. The monument is not supposed to be to him. The monument, he believed, was to the Anglican Church. It's the first Anglican cathedral. To his science, because the structure of the dome is so astonishing, and to those two Charleses, Charles I and Charles II, whom he served throughout his life.
Would, if he had become, if he had been an astronomer, if he had been mathematician, if he had been physician and had not done all the buildings that he did, would he still be remembered?
That is a wonderful question. It needs another hour to answer, I feel sure. It's a wonderful question. I can't answer that. Of course, buildings stand in ways that even telescopes tend not to. I'd like to think he would have been as outstanding a medical man or scientist as he was an architect. But thank goodness he settled for architecture.
Well, I appreciate very much you taking the time to talk with us. A very interesting subject, and I certainly will suggest to people, if they would like to read more, to look for the book that we have mentioned, On a Grander Scale, The Outstanding Life of Sir Christopher Wren, published by HarperCollins, by our guest, Lisa Jardine. She's professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London. And thank you, Lisa, very much for talking
with us. Thank you so much for having me with you today.